Wahhabi or maybe Sunni scholars. I mean, it makes it more strange because in our time, we expect all the Muslim scholars to check everything with the, genuine sources.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever.
The scholars you mentioned right now were some 200 to 50 years old. Mm-hmm. And even if they said that, they had no access to, you know, say, internet information. But today, you can do, you know, live debates with the scholars of other religions. You can study contemporary religion. I mean, everything is at your hands. And still, there are claims. So I would definitely want to know what are the contemporary claims.
Yeah, let me refer to one of the contemporary Wahhabi scholars in our time, Abdullah Al-Qamisi. He has a book called As-Sira' Bayn al-Islam wal-Wataniyya in volume 1, page 374. He is, of course, too impolite. Sorry for translating his words. The most stupid of the people, the most foolish of the people, are the one who made their imams hidden in Sardab, referring to the Shia.
Oh.
And they are the ones who every night they come to this Sardab together with their horses. They believe that their imam is hidden there. They are waiting for him and they call him to come out, to reappear. The weird point is that this is repeating for about 1,000 years up until today. So come on, man. I mean,
okay. You're living in a contemporary world.
Yeah, so and you can check it.
And if you want to say something, world needs proof.
Exactly.
You can at least upload one of the videos and then claim something. Like you're throwing things in the air.
And not only him, we can mention another Wahhabi scholar, Mustafa Hilmi in Nizam al-Khilafah, page 267, and some other ones which I'm not going to mention. For example, when I told the story for you, I think you also get surprised that is there any Shia who have ever believed that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam was hidden there and he will...
Exactly.
I mean, at the beginning of this session, you said that we all heard that he will reappear from the Kaaba.
Reappear from the Kaaba, yeah.
So even no Shia has heard about that. So with all these narrations, how can one claim that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam disappeared there and will reappear there? Inshallah, I will refer to some narration in this regard in the following session.
Definitely, we would want to know where the Imam disappeared and where will he reappear, although we have a lot of narrations also in Sunni school of thought, also in Shia school of thought, that Imam is going to reappear from Kaaba, but where from he disappeared, and more narrations about his disappearance and reappearance. We'll talk on them in next session. Thank you so much, Dr. Karimi, for being with us.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to IRIB English Radio. This was Last Savior, and this is your humble host, Zainab, saying goodbye. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witches.
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
The working conditions at American giant retail company Amazon have been subject to a myriad of complaints by the employees. Complaints initially gained national and international attention because of the too few bathroom breaks inhumanely imposed on Amazon staff and drivers in an attempt to maximize productivity and speedy delivery of goods to customers. And it was indeed a blatant attempt to boost profits for the owners of the company, most notably its owner and executive chairman, Jeff Bezos, one of the richest men in the world, whose net worth has now exceeded $180 billion U.S. dollars.
Amazon Labor Union.
Hello and welcome to We the People, everyone. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and in today's episode, we'll investigate the working conditions for the average worker at Amazon, which is reported to be often tough and occasionally unsafe. While Amazon shareholders and customers are mostly happy with the retail giant, the workers, such as those in the warehouses, often have a very different experience. For years, the workers have been making effort to improve the situation, but have not managed to bring about any real change as Amazon keeps suppressing any voices of dissent via its powerful means of crackdown. In today's episode, we'll be joined by Lauren Steiner with a robust opposition to delve deeper into the issue and what could be done about it. And later, we'll be joined by Eric Ramos, union iron worker, mutual aid organizer, and member of the Communist Party USA from Chicago. Stay with us.
Workers in warehouses are tracked with a computer algorithm rather than being reported or written up by any superintendents. Therefore, they get no chance to do anything challenging to the system and are basically expected to perform like robots. Amazon has continued to track every minute of most warehouse workers' shifts, from how fast they pack merchandise to how long they pause.
Now, many have drawn attention to the highly questionable way that Amazon's computerized system hires, monitors, and fires workers based on performance at the service of profit, rendering a cruel juggernaut with no mercy or understanding of real human needs. So is Amazon capitalizing on its workforce to make increasingly greater profits by pressuring employees through measures such as cutting their break times?
Well, I first learned about unfair conditions Amazon warehouses when I lived in Los Angeles. Many of them were not properly cooled and workers were collapsing from heat exhaustion. The other thing that was famously reported is that they have so much that they have to produce. They don't have time to take bathroom breaks and they were peeing in bottles. I know Chris Smalls started his walkout because during the pandemic, they weren't following proper safety procedures. There was not enough PPE, hand sanitizers. They weren't doing proper social distancing. A lot of service workers, restaurant workers, for instance, the Starbucks workers, they don't get regular hours. They keep them below 30 hours a week, and they don't give them the schedule until a couple of days before the week begins, so they can't, you know, even get a second job.
The already dire conditions has worsened with the breakout of the coronavirus pandemic, which has made more and more Americans rely on the retail delivery service and consequently leading to a bigger workload for the warehouse workers and truck drivers. The employment machine has had to work increasingly harder, which has made the working conditions even more arduous.
Well, I think the workers need to, you know, start unions, which is what they're doing right now. I mean, that's really all they can do. I mean, people have complained to management before with no success. So starting a union is something that forces management to have to listen to them.
Now, as more residents have to rely on online shopping today, in part over fears of shopping in person, Amazon and its founder Jeff Bezos have used its complex and technologically advanced systems to assure the happiness of customers on the one side and to maximize profits for the corporation on the other. So is that going to change with the latest effort by workers in Staten Island? And how could the latest quest by Amazon employees to unionize be assessed?
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, when you hear from people on the ground, it was a big factor to them that basically this was an effort that was done by the workers themselves. You know, it was a big choice for them to start their own independent union, opposed to trying to gain representation through established unions. You know, for them, that meant that, I mean, it's a lot easier to trust them. It dismantles the rhetoric from corporations, and especially the campaign that Amazon was running, that basically says that that unions are a third-party entity that get between the workers and the bosses, and that their goal is to, you know, gather as many members as possible to you know, basically just to get more dues, you know, so that the union itself can become richer.
Amazon's numerical understanding of the real people has led to unprecedented human suffering, which cannot be represented in numbers. With the sharp spike in demands due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the company has touted breathtaking job creation numbers, and from July to October 2020 alone, it managed to hire up 350,000 new workers.
Now, most of the Amazon workers are hired through computer screening and with no or little conversation with an interviewer. Now, it should come as no big surprise that the working conditions are very similar. What is next for the employees' efforts to make working conditions any better?
Well, I think that it's, as I said in the answer to the first question, I think that Amazon's success is going to be very inspirational. Chris Smalls said in a press conference the other day that 100 different Amazon stores have contacted him about, you know, starting unionization efforts. He's going to be on my show again, and I'm going to have on the people in Raleigh, North Carolina, which is where I live now. I live in North Carolina because they're trying to unionize their place of work. So I think it's just going to be a big multiplier.
Now, the bathroom breaks were just a tipping point of the dire working conditions at Amazon, and soon a trove of evidence and complaints appeared on U.S. news and media outlets involving just how workers' rights are being violated by the American multinational tech company.
So I think one of the biggest things to talk about is this thing called TOT. It means time off task. So basically, all the employees are closely monitored to determine, like, how much time is spent not doing their assigned task. This doesn't mean, like, it's not just, like, talking to each other. It's not just checking your phone. It's, I'm going to the bathroom or going to get a drink of water. And if this time builds up, they can actually be fired for it, for having built up enough time off tasks.
Just recently, Amazon workers at the Staten Island facility voted by a wide margin to form a union, despite all the pressure imposed on them by the men on top. The measure has been described as a revolution at the company, which has so far spared no efforts to crack down on the smallest of attempts by the workers to unionize. Generally speaking, what are the issues workers in big companies such as Amazon are facing, and what should be done to address those issues?
We have this thing in this country where so many workers are like the workers there, who are basically getting a minimum wage rates And, you know, most workers don't want to organize because they're afraid they'll just get fired. Or if they put in a lot of time in a company, you know, it hurts. They don't necessarily want to leave, but a lot of the time they'll just be like, well, it pays the same at other places, so they'll just quit and get a job somewhere else. And I think that more and more workers are starting to see that, you know, that's just a problem, that conditions are going to be the same everywhere you go. So fortunately, we've seen, you know, I think that a lot of workers are going to be inspired by the ALU, the Amazon Labor Union, and see that, you know, it can be done. And I mean, hopefully we're not just going to see more Amazon warehouses start to organize in the same way, but also across industries just like it, you know.
Now, the company, which focuses on e-commerce, cloud computing, digital streaming, and artificial intelligence, among other things, is just one of many corporations in America which seeks to gain as much as profit as possible, even if it means imposing ever-grueling regulations on its workers. Now, the workers are naturally from the working class and struggle to survive in the capitalistic economy of America.
These different sectors are being used against each other. As far as for, you know, workers in general, everyone feels the squeeze, like I said. Everyone is expected to work longer hours for less pay and less benefits. You know, they're seeing that their money is not going as far as it wants year after year when they are getting raises. And, you know, it's just, it's crazy. It's almost like, it's reminiscent of how it was 100 years ago in the previous American labor movement, you know. People working longer hours for less pay, and people are finally getting sick of it, you know. Yeah.
For years, the American workers have been striving to raise the minimum wage, yet mostly to no avail. Currently, the federal minimum wage for covered non-exempt employees is $7.25 per hour, which many workers deem to be way below what they need to cover the expenses of their livelihood. For long, American workers have been demanding a higher minimum wage. But are those demands going to materialize?
Well, the minimum wage hasn't been raised in many years. And in California, it was raised a few years ago to $15 an hour, and it was done gradually. So only now in 2022 did it become $15 an hour. But of course, in California, $15 an hour is too low of a minimum wage. It's not even a living wage. And here in Asheville, North Carolina, where I live, you know, the state minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. And they've determined that the living wage in Asheville here is $17.70 an hour. So, and this is a smaller city. This is not Los Angeles or New York. And they don't have unions here. It's a right-to-work state.
Meanwhile, Jeff Bezos has said that he is proud of the company's work culture, productivity goals, as well as the pay and benefits. He is not alone. The work culture in America's huge corporations is designed by the wealthy 1% owners to make sure that they can make more and more money at the cost of ruining everyone else's lives.
My son works these minimum wage jobs. The last employer he had, if they weren't busy, they would send him home, and of course they wouldn't pay him for these hours. So this is what they call precarity. It's a very precarious workplace, and they don't have a lot of rights. Now, you know, in the 50s, 30% of the American workforce was unionized. Now it's just 10%, and 6% of private employers' workforce is unionized. So they just don't have a lot of power, and that creates... That's one of the major causes for income inequality in this country.
So the men in power, they seek to provide as little wages and protection as possible and put the company's goals way above their workers' livelihoods. That has created fewer reliable jobs, more temporary work arrangements, declining wages, and ever-increasing high-stress conditions for the working class in the United States.
The thing is that, you know, real wage is a number... And economics used to kind of measure how much wages, you know, how much buying power generally wages have. And that's a number we've seen constantly decreasing over the decades and remaining stagnant. Even though some places have been able to increase their wages, you know, we see that corporations continue to impose higher prices on society in general, which continues to raise the cost of living for everyone. Even people like myself who work in unions, and you know, unions are often able to negotiate a 3% increase in wages to keep up with this. It hasn't been enough either.
It's not easy to keep working at Amazon, so workers keep quitting their jobs due to the impossible demands from the corporation's algorithm, with a turnover among the workforce roughly standing at 150% a year. Capitalizing on the workforce to make increasingly greater profits is not a novel phenomenon in America. Indeed, many experts believe that is what America and capitalism in general have been founded upon.
There was the PRO Act, which was a very important bill that was introduced last year that was passed by the House. And of course, the Senate won't pass it because, you know, it wouldn't, even if it got all Democrats voting for it, it wouldn't survive the filibuster. And the PRO Act would have outlawed anti-union meetings. It would enact federal financial penalties for threatening or firing workers, and it would help wrongfully terminated workers win reinstatement. So while that PRO Act did not pass, the National Labor Relations Board just issued a memo saying that that companies can't have these anti-union meetings.
Some experts believe that the quality of life is increasingly lowering, and biggest issue facing the American economy and political system is a gradual descent of the middle class into proletarian status. Now, since the 1970s, this process has been going on intermittently and has worsened considerably in recent years.
Our government is essentially, you know, bought by these corporations. The only thing that's ever really been effective is workers organizing in this way. And, you know, it's great to see that it's finally happening. I think we're seeing a resurgence of the labor movements here. I think they're going to have to do what's always worked, which is, you know, organizing and starting these unionization efforts and hopefully building across different lines of the entire American workforce to ultimately, I think that they'll have to build a political arm that actually represents them, that can actually enact a lot of the changes necessary to maintain the gains that they've made.
The way workers are treated in the U.S. keeps on increasing the inequality and injustice running rampant in the country. Enormous wealth is delivered to top executives and shareholders, while little is left for the people at the bottom. The dehumanizing manner in which Amazon conducts its business is spreading among other corporations, which would in part demand dangerously high production quotas likewise.
As long as the goalposts continue to get moved, as far as wages are concerned, you know, it's not gonna matter enough. It's not gonna be enough. What I think is gonna happen is that, you know, workers will succeed in getting wages increased, but we're likely going to see the cost of living skyrocket in response. And I think that after that, you know, workers are going to continue to see this. The facade of inflation is going to continue to thin, and they'll kind of realize that once again, a political arm is going to be necessary for the labor movement in order to ensure greater buying power.
In order to survive in the job market and to keep making ends meet, employees have to push harder to hit impracticable levels. They have to work harder and harder because they feel they're falling down on the job, as the demands by their employers are purposely designed to be unattainable for most workers. So whether or not efforts to unionize are going to change the situation for the better is yet to be seen. Now let's see what Abbas Motarim has prepared for us this week.
A huge victory happened for workers at the Amazon warehouse in Staten Island, New York, when the workers voted to unionize. It's arguably one of the biggest labor union victories in modern history. But what does this mean? What does it mean for the masses of workers? And what does it mean for the labor movement? On this episode of Power to the People, we will take a look at this recent labor victory and dive into what it means for workers' rights all across the world. But before we talk about this labor union victory, it's important that we look at some of Amazon's notorious inhumane work practices, whether it be wage theft, dangerous workplace conditions during the COVID-19 pandemic, which led to over 20,000 plus cases that we know of, as we know that Amazon was revealed to concealing the number of cases around workers testing positive. But not only that, Amazon has used mass surveillance on employees to make sure that they are working fast and also have forced delivery drivers to have 14-hour days and no bathroom breaks. The list of inhumane practices go on and on. We can literally do a whole segment on Amazon's inhumane practices. And these practices, they have made Jeff Bezos the second richest man in the world. Literally, while Jeff Bezos is on his yacht or taking excursions to space, workers are being exploited and being forced to pee in bottles because their work break isn't enough. This exploitation has led to attempts at unions to be founded throughout the country. And the first one to be successful is the establishment of the Amazon Labor Union, which was led by Chris Smalls, who used to work for Amazon, but he was fired as he led a protest against Amazon for the lack of COVID-19 safety measures in the warehouse. Smalls, he began organizing, and over a year after being fired, he successfully launched a campaign to unionize his former workplace. As the union had captured 2,654 votes, while 2,131 votes were against it. The chickens truly came home to roost for Amazon and Jeff Bezos. And this undoubtedly, it's a historic win. Workers' rights at the warehouse should immediately improve, and it is a huge positive step for people working at that specific warehouse. But what is the full scope of the impact? Well, we are already seeing this victory being co-opted by the state. Bernie Sanders, a liberal Zionist, has been invited to speak with Chris Smalls, which in many ways exposes the lack of strong revolutionary ideology behind the movement. And this is something that workers' unions, they must address, which is a lack of revolutionary ideology. As we see a warehouse and Amazon unionizing, as well as we see a Starbucks shop unionizing, it might create a ripple effect amongst corporate workplaces throughout the world. And this will undoubtedly, it will undoubtedly improve American workers' conditions. But what does this mean for workers and colonized people across the world? These corporations aren't just here in America. They are global corporations and are a part of international finance capital that has been developed through imperialism. So while workers in America begin getting more rights and a welfare state under capitalism is expanded, these corporations, what is they gonna do? They just gonna extend their exploitation overseas and begin exploiting colonized people more than they already are to make up for the money lost due to unionization and workers getting more rights here in America. This is why it's important for workers' unions to have a revolutionary ideology. Workers' unions must fundamentally be anti-capitalist as well as anti-imperialist and must seek to end this parasitic system known as capitalism. Because what is an improvement? What is an improvement in working conditions here in America if we know that this American capitalist is going to go overseas to exploit other colonized people working in factories? And this is part of the evils of imperialism, and it's part of the evils of capitalism. And this is why unions must develop revolutionary internationalist stances that don't just focus on American workers. And throughout history, we've seen examples, whether it's the ILWU not allowing cargo from apartheid South Africa, as well as the ILWU not allowing cargo from Zionist Israel. We must understand that international solidarity is a must, and unions must develop international solidarity. This is Power to the People.
I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and make sure to tune in next time when we return with another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime is doubling down on its apartheid rule over Palestinians while it and its international accomplices attempt to fend off the label. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Maureen Claire Murphy, journalist. This article is titled, Zionist Regime Doubles Down on Apartheid. Here's more on this issue. The Zionist regime is doubling down on its apartheid rule over Palestinians, while it and its international accomplices attempt to fend off the label. Recently, the Zionist regime reinstated a ban on Palestinian family unification as part of its demographic engineering efforts to ensure a Jewish majority in the territory of historic Palestine. Adala, a group that advocates for the rights of Palestinians in the occupied territories, said that the legislation is one of the most racist and discriminatory laws in the world and must immediately be repealed. The Citizenship and Entry into Israel order prohibits the Zionist regime's interior minister from granting residency or citizenship to Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza who marry citizens of the occupied territories. According to Adala, which will challenge the law at the Zionist regime's high court, it also bans unification between a citizen or resident of Palestinian territories with spouses from Syria, Lebanon, Iraq. Adala added that UN human rights bodies have called on the Zionist regime to revoke the ban on Palestinian family unification as it violates the international law. The Zionist regime's parliament, the Knesset, has renewed the temporary order banning family unification 21 times over the past 18 years, the rights group added. However, unlike in the past, the current version of the law explicitly states that its purpose is to ensure a Jewish demographic majority, Adala added. The Zionist regime lawmakers and Ayelet Shaked, the regime's interior minister, has said the legislation is intended to prevent Palestinians from gradually returning to their homeland. Demographic engineering is also informing the Zionist regime's policy on refugees fleeing the violence. Recently, Shaked said that the influx of mostly non-Jewish Ukrainians fleeing to the occupied territories cannot go on. Shaked added, anyone with a brain understand that we can't continue at this rate of entry. The Zionist regime's obsession with demographics is nothing new. It has prevented millions of Palestinian refugees and their descendants from exercising the right to return to lands from which they were forcibly displaced on the basis that they are not Jewish. Shaked acknowledged the apartheid nature of the family unification law by tweeting that its approval was a victory for a Jewish and demographic regime and a loss for a regime of all its citizens. The Zionist regime's law, passed in 2018, stipulates that the right to exercise self-determination in Israel is unique to the Jewish people. Stateless Palestinians living in the West Bank and Gaza face similar restrictions, with the Zionist regime refusing to confer residency status to foreign nationals who are married to Palestinians living in those territories. Jewish settlers face no such restrictions. Amnesty International highlights the Zionist regime's denial of nationality, residence, and family life in its recent report, finding that the Zionist regime practices apartheid against Palestinians. The suspension of family unification procedures in the West Bank and Gaza affects tens of thousands of foreign nationals married to Palestinians. Meanwhile, the Zionist regime prohibits Palestinians in Gaza from residing in the West Bank. The human rights group Al-Haq has stated that Palestinians are forced to make life choices as personal as who they marry and where they live based on the constraints of the Zionist regime policies and practices that not only target them but are ultimately aimed at their transfer. Since its inception, the Zionist regime has prevented Palestinians from living in their homeland through the mass expulsions and displacements in 1948 and 1967 and permanently cancelling the residency status of Palestinians in the West Bank, including Al-Quds. As a result of those efforts, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who were born in Palestine are now considered foreigners with no immediate right of entry or stay by the Zionist regime, according to Al-Haq. The Zionist regime also prevents Palestinians living under military occupation from exercising freedom of movement, imposing arbitrary travel bans on more than 10,500 Palestinians in the West Bank last year. The Tel Aviv Daily Haaretz reported recently that the Zionist regime will vet any foreign lecturers wishing to teach at Palestinian universities in the West Bank. Universities will be able to employ lecturers from abroad only if they teach in fields that have been designated as essential by the Zionist regime. The prospective lecturers must hold a doctorate and will have to submit applications for such permits at the Zionist regime consulate in the applicant's country of origin. COGAT, the bureaucratic arm of the Zionist regime's military occupation, will ultimately approve any entry of a lecturer. That body exercises control over the movement of people and goods in and out of Gaza, including medical patients seeking care not available in the besieged territory, whose life-saving treatment is frequently denied or delayed. From September 2020 to March 2021, the Zionist regime denied or delayed the travel applications of one-third of all Gaza patients seeking medical treatment in the occupied territories and the West Bank. Applicants seeking to teach at Palestinian universities will have to prove to the Zionist regime's satisfaction that they will make a significant contribution to academic education, to the regional economy, or to the promotion of regional cooperation and peace. The Zionist regime defines virtually anyone who criticizes it or advocates for Palestinian rights to be against peace. This means that the Zionist regime will in effect be imposing total political control over Palestinian universities. According to Haaretz, the number of lecturers will be limited by a quota to be determined by Israel, which currently stands at 100. Meanwhile, only 150 foreign students will be allowed to study at Palestinian universities per year, and COGAT will determine the fields of study open to them. The new restrictions, expected to be implemented in May, have spurred renewed calls for the boycott of Israeli academic institutions, many of which have deep ties to the Zionist regime, occupation, apartheid, and settler colonization in Palestine.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic. One of the points that has been frequently mentioned in the prayers of this month, both day and night prayers, is the issue of asking God for forgiveness. We must ask God to forgive us. In certain prayers, there is a statement saying, "This is the month of forgiveness." Asking God for His forgiveness is frequently mentioned in these prayers. Well, what does forgiveness mean? It means apologizing. We must apologize to God the Exalted. We must apologize to Him for many things that we did and that we did not do. This act of asking for divine forgiveness, which is done with a pure intention, gives you a purity that attracts divine mercy. We must try to attract divine mercy and divine blessings. In prayers we read, "O God, I ask you to bring about the circumstances for your mercy." There are certain circumstances which lead to divine mercy. This asking for forgiveness is effective in all areas of life.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
There is an ayah, a verse, in Surah Al-Hud, in Chapter Hud, about the common affairs of life. And my people, ask forgiveness of your Lord and turn to Him in repentance. He will send you the skies pouring abundant rain. In other words, God the Exalted shows heavenly blessings on you. After that, God says, and add strength to your strength. The Holy Quran, chapter 11, verse 52. This increases your strength and power. This is very important. This is not a personal matter, rather it is a public and national matter. The effect of asking for divine forgiveness in one of the most difficult arenas of life, fighting against the enemy, is more clearly explained in a holy ayah and verse in the auspicious Surah Al-Imran. How many of the prophets fought, and with them fought, large bands of godly men, but they never lost heart if they met with disaster in God's way, nor did they weaken, nor give in. And God loves those who are firm and steadfast. All they said was, "Our Lord, forgive us our sins and anything we may have done that transgressed our duty." Holy Quran, chapter 3, verses 146 to 147.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
For the first time since the onset of the COVID pandemic, hundreds of people of faith and none gathered in the shadow of North London's Finsbury Park Mosque to enjoy a breaking of the fast in a public setting. The iftar, backed by the local council and organised by Finsbury Park Mosque, Muslim Welfare House and British Muslim charity Islamic Relief, was an opportunity for the community to gather, celebrate and reflect.
It's good to show solidarity, Muslim, non-Muslim, Jews, Christian, all coming together to share a meal. This is a very powerful message that we are united, we are all at one despite our differences.
It's important because it's a very visible sign of the friendship and, you know, the togetherness that we have all through the year, actually. But and it's such lovely hospitality.
For me, it's an opportunity to, I suppose, show solidarity with my Muslim sisters and also, as Pauline said, take part in this wonderful experience.
It's no coincidence that this gathering is taking place during Ramadan, one of the most revered periods in the Islamic calendar, a time not just for abstention and reflection, but to help those who are less fortunate.
Ramadan is a time when we're always thinking about our friends, our family, our neighbours, our community at large. And I think it's one of those moments when we can all gather together, especially after the last couple of years when we haven't been able to do that.
The street iftar party was first organised in June 2017, just days after the terror attack in the Finsbury Park area on Muslim worshippers during the month of Ramadan that cost one man his life and injured nine others. The public iftar was a way for communities to show solidarity and silence hatred with hope.
Tonight, we celebrate. We celebrate the achievements of the Muslim community in this area. We celebrate and thank them for all that they do, and we enjoy a wonderful iftar supper.
This is in memory of our beloved brother Makram Ali, who lost his life in this incident, unfortunately. And we are here. We want to have it every year to, you know, remember what's happened and try to bring communities together after what's happened. happened. And this is the main idea, is to bring us together, to say to those who try to divide us and spread hatred, fear and division that you will not succeed. We are together and we will be always together. Islamophobia has no place in our society, and we should all fight it.
At a time of global disunity, one small corner of North London is showing there is another way. Amina Taylor, London.
The Journalists' Union in Damascus organized a ceremony to pay tribute to journalists who were killed in battlefields while reporting on the years-long war on Syria. Officials attending the ceremony praised the sacrifices of those journalists, who included reporters, cameramen, and employees of media outlets.
Syrian journalists had double the responsibility. They faced a ferocious war waged by huge media outlets on Syria. Journalists wrote their words in blood in respect of their job, homeland, and principles. We remain loyal to the blood of our martyrs.
It was unfortunately a long list of those who were killed, but a reminder of the sacrifices made for the sake of defending Syria. Families and relatives received certificates of appreciation, including one for Press TV correspondent Maya Nasser, who I proudly received it on behalf of his family.
This ceremony means a lot. It means that the martyrs are always remembered in the media outlets they work for. They sacrifice their lives for the sake of the country. We are proud of their sacrifices.
We used to miss him a lot, even when he was alive. He worked most of the time. After leaving for work for a whole month, we saw him once, and then he was killed. It's a nice gesture to honor him by the Journalists' Union.
Maya Nasser was killed by terrorists in 2012 while covering an attack on the Ministry of Defense in the Syrian capital. He was one of many journalists who was keen on being on front lines to deliver the truth and perform his duty. In Syria, tens of journalists fearlessly risked their lives, were injured or killed just to convey the truth amid a ferocious mainstream media campaign to distort the reality. Honoring those journalists underlines the crucial role the media plays in any war, especially nowadays. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The French presidential election is being described as a populist bloc of Marine Le Pen versus an elitist bloc of Emmanuel Macron, but many don't seem to want to join either group. The first round's third-place finisher held an internal poll. Almost 70% of his leftist supporters will either abstain or submit blank ballots rather than vote for either candidate. France's Muslims don't see a choice which isn't Islamophobic. Macron continues to support bashing Islamo-leftism, while Le Pen has an on-again, off-again plan to give fines for wearing the hijab in public. The student class isn't taking sides either. They recently blocked universities over what they say are two bad candidates.
The elder class may provide the key vote. Back when he expected an easy victory, Macron promised to raise the retirement age to 65. Now he's backtracking in an effort to win over left-wing voters, but many aren't sure what his true plans really are.
Le bilan d'Emmanuel Macron n'est pas forcément positif.
Macron's record isn't very positive. Long-term unemployment, economic instability, the destabilizing effects of the yellow vests. People have many different reasons for being disappointed with him.
In 2017, the two mainstream parties were swept out of power, but the repeat second-round matchup has many voters upset that new ideas remain absent.
La ligne conservatrice, réactionnaire.
The conservative and reactionary line is championed by Le Pen, but she's very divisive. Many of her electorate preferred Eric Zemmour in the first round, and then there are many mainstream conservatives who will never vote for her or the National Rally. The key traits of this vote are bitter abstention and bored indecisiveness.
Most polls show Macron leading by around 6 to 8 points, but that's within the margin of error, and Western polls have consistently undercounted the right nationalist candidate. The runoff is on April 24th. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
There are many security experts who claim the expansion of NATO in recent years close to Russia's borders and provocative military exercises are factors that brought about the conflict in Ukraine. Now EU members Finland and Sweden are poised to announce they want to join NATO. One analyst has been giving us his reaction via broadband.
That's a very serious escalation toward Russia, because this is when the United States will put nuclear bombs in Finland, and that would mean a direct escalation that Russia will not accept.
Finland shares a border with Russia that is more than 1,300 kilometres long. Moscow points out that if this country was to join the 30-nation alliance, NATO's land border with the Russian Federation would more than double in length. A new opinion poll by Le Soir newspaper has found that 90% of citizens surveyed in Belgium said the war worries them, but that they do not support direct military intervention over concerns that it could trigger a new world war. A quarter of those questioned said the West's supply of weapons to fighters in Ukraine is, quote, a bad thing. We have also been asking members of the public about this.
Yeah, I think we should stop doing that, huh? Because, war... fights war and then ends up in more war. So it's more about like discussing, talking.
It's a very good thing to have a dialogue with Russians and hopefully sort this out without war.
Ideally, diplomacy is the way that this comes to an end, but it takes two sides. From what I'm reading, they don't want to negotiate at all yet.
On Tuesday, the European Commission defended the decisions taken by EU governments to send arms to Ukraine.
In this case, more weapons doesn't mean more war. More weapons for Ukraine means more ability for the Ukrainian army to defend its people.
As concerns over possible escalation continue to increase, Finland and Sweden are expected to announce, before the end of this month, if they intend to join NATO. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
People in the west of Afghan capital Kabul were once again terrified after three explosions hit an educational center and a high school, leaving dozens of people dead and injured. Soon after the attack, we rushed Abdulrahim Shahid High School to talk with eyewitnesses.
After the first explosion, I arrived at the scene. Then suddenly the next blast hit the school alley. I saw dozens of students fall on the ground. People started to take the dead and wounded to hospital.
The targeted school is located in Hazaraz residential area, where the K-12